Hello, I'm Bruce Selrig. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. This is Financial Literacy Month. Hooray for that. And we are continuing with our focus on newcomers. Today, we'll speak with Carolina Restrepo and Juan Carla. They came to Canada from Colombia 6 years ago. And one of the things they've done since they have arrived is built a platform called Mundo Together, which is a place where they can share their experience with other newcomers. And today, the focus of our conversation is what they have learned as it relates to integrating with the Canadian financial system. Then Eva Wong will be our guest. She is co-founder and chief operating officer of Borrowell. She'll share some tips on some of the challenges that that newcomers face and tricks about how you can increase your credit score quicker than you ever thought possible. Adding an authorized user on another person's credit card, getting your rent to count in building your score, and something that they have called a credit builder loan. So we'll talk about those ideas. Later in the show, we'll talk about the mighty RESP. How early is too early to sign up for the Registered Education Savings Plan? Hint, as soon as you have the baby's social insurance number, right away. Craig Hughes, Director of Tax and Estate Planning at IG Wealth Management. We'll talk about that process. And food economist and Professor Mike Von Massow will be here to talk about tipping culture in Canada, how one company is warning customers their order might be delayed if they don't leave a tip. Moolala's financial literacy focus is made possible by our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, Easy Financial, personal, home equity, and auto loans with personalized rates and terms made for you. Indeed Canada, the number one job site worldwide, the number one source of hire here in Canada. The Canadian Bankers Association, the voice of more than 60 domestic and foreign banks here, helping drive Canada's economic growth and prosperity. And Achieve, a leading charitable organization that delivers employment, newcomer, language, youth, women, and inclusion services in the Greater Toronto area. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. We have been focusing on the newcomer experience this entire financial literacy month. It is such an important demographic. There is so much for newcomers to learn as they integrate into our country. And today, we're going to talk to two relative newcomers to Canada. Carolina Restrepo and Juan Carla immigrated to Canada from Colombia about 6 years ago. And one of the things they have done, in addition to sorting out their life here, is to create a platform called Mundo Together to share their experience joining Canada and learning all about life here. And they're joining us today from Kitchener, Ontario. Hello to you both.
Hello. Hey,
how are you, Bruce?
I am well. Carolina, I want to start with you. What do you remember about your very, very, very first day in Canada? Please tell me it was not in February. Please tell me you showed up in September.
Yeah, I actually arrived during August, so the weather was just perfect. And actually the first day that I arrived, Juan took me to Niagara Falls. So it was such an incredible day for me.
Wow. Okay, that's great. Now, Juan, you were already here. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So you had a little bit more experience when it comes to the financial system and integrating with the, you know, the Canadian way of doing things. What was relatively easy and what was relatively hard for you in terms of building that financial life?
I think the hardest aspect was that you're starting from scratch. You really have nothing here when you first arrive. So firstly, I didn't have a credit score. I didn't have any idea of how the credit score worked here. So understanding how to build a good credit score and being able to do it, because one thing is understanding it is, and the other thing is when you first arrive and you have limited income, you have to find a way to make it work as well and make it work in your favor so that you can actually leverage that credit score to accomplish whatever you want to accomplish when you first arrive.
What would you both say, and either of you can answer this, what would you both say you did well in establishing the credit score? And what did you do not so well? And bonus points for revealing some unbelievable mistake that you made that you have since recovered from, but will reassure others that it's kind of hard to do perfectly.
Yeah.
Carolina's looking at what, okay, yeah, you're going to go first.
I can share. Yeah, I can share my experience. So when I first arrived, I remember that the bank that I joined, they gave me a credit card with a very low limit. It was like $500. And I didn't know the fact that you have to just keep your, you know, your expending up to a point, and you're not supposed to use your full capacity of your credit. And I did that for several months, actually, until Juan was like, what are you doing? Yeah, so I did that. That was a big mistake. I did it for like, I don't know, 6 months or something like that, because it was so low. I thought like, I better just use it, right? It's like normal. I didn't think that it was going to affect my credit score. But yeah, thankfully Juan called me on that. Yeah.
Juan, do you remember either something that you did well or a mistake that you made?
I think one thing that we both did well was getting our credit card as soon as we arrived, because we started to use it right away. So we started to create that credit score. And then after 6 months or a year, I think we were able to increase that limit that we had in those credit cards. So that's that's something that I did really well. And I think I taught her right in that, which I was actually reading a lot of articles during that time. And I was watching videos and stuff, trying to understand how to increase our score. Because again, our score was like nothing at that moment. And the one thing that I did badly, I think, also overusing my credit card at the beginning, because, yeah, it's challenging at the beginning when you have a limited income and then you're trying to build a credit score, but also cover all the expenses when you first arrive. So
we have people coming to Canada from literally every country on the planet over the course of a year. What would you say are some things that you noticed culturally between Colombia and Canada as it relates to money? And it could be things like, you know, in some countries, it is a cash-oriented culture. Canada is very much plastic. It could be things like how one talks about money at the dinner table with family. What would be some things that you noticed culturally?
I think one important thing is the cash usage. In Colombia, everyone uses cash. Actually, not too many people have credit cards. Like many people in the cities, in the large cities do, but not in the countryside of the country. As in Canada, people use credit cards for everything. Like I barely use cash anymore. I don't carry cash in my wallet anymore. And in Colombia, because you use cash all the time, people see credit cards as their enemy sometimes. Like they're scared of using their credit cards because they think they're not going to be able to pay them off, or that you're always paying interest to banks, because people don't really understand that if you pay before a certain date, you don't have to pay interest on your purchases. So I think that is a huge difference, and that took us some time to understand and interiorize while we arrived.
Now, but there's a part of that that I can imagine would serve you well. The fear of using the card. A part of me is like, yeah, more of that. We need more of that. We need people to be more concerned about putting money on the credit card. Carolina, did you find that you had that? Was there some reticence that was a hangover from your upbringing in Colombia?
I think in Colombia, you're also like, whenever you use a credit card, you also pay any payment on installments. Like it doesn't matter if it is like $5, you'll put that in like 24 months installments. Like people don't actually understand. Yeah, people don't actually understand that you're gonna be paying like double of that amount if you put that for so long. But that's actually pretty common. Like in our country, I don't know, like maybe that's why they think the credit card is the enemy, because every time it's like 24 months for a super small payment.
I was going to say, that's one of the biggest differences. I had totally forgotten about that. But yeah, like every time you purchase something in Colombia, any establishment asks you like, okay, how many installments do you want to divide this purchase in? And you can go up to 48 if you want, or you can do two or three or four. And that's in every single purchase.
Yeah.
So people
I wish our radio listeners could see my face right now, because I'm like, what? I mean, I know that we have installment plans are a thing, but they are so rare. Yeah. They're just not a part of how Canadians who've been here for generations. Okay. It's not how we operate.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mentioned Mundo Together. How did that idea come to be? Why did you decide to launch that?
So we wanted to help other people that had a similar project of like immigrating to a country. Mm-hmm. We first started sharing our information in English because we wanted different cultures to being able to follow us and understand everything we were saying. However, we started seeing a lot of people from Latin America and also Latin people living in Canada and the US following us. And that's why we made the switch to doing everything in Spanish so that people could understand better everything that we were sharing. Mm-hmm. So it was mostly the idea of trying to help people that are newcomers get a better idea of what the country was about, like how everything worked, what the different challenges were going to be when they arrived. Mm-hmm. And for those that live here that don't have a lot of information on many things, that they could also understand things that we were already understanding mm-hmm. during our process. Mm-hmm. So,
Carolina, you cover lots of different topics, and I'm sure you receive lots of different questions. As you think about the financial world, broadly defined, what would you say is the question that is asked the most, or mm-hmm. the topic that most resonates with your viewers that you're like, okay, we got to do this yet again, because there's such a demand for it?
Talking about financial topics. Well, one of them is the first one, like how do I get my first credit card? Where do I open my first bank account? Things like that. But another current question is how to invest. Like people are looking to learn more about that topic. And I think it's actually pretty interesting because they're like, okay, I'm here. I'm already stable. Like I found a job. I found these things. I'm saving, but now I want to actually invest and like make that money grow for me. So that's actually one of the questions that we have received the most lately.
One of the dynamics that I would believe to be relevant for your platform is that because you speak in Spanish, you have people who come to Canada who may not immigrate here forever. They may not be going for permanent residency. They may be here seasonally. They may be workers who come up to work in the fruit orchards and then head back home to their home country. What are some of the differences for people who come and contribute to Canada in that way that are different from how you've mm-hmm. chosen to be here and you've made your life here 12 months a year?
I will say the biggest difference will be that they are mostly doing that so they can send money home, back home. So they're actually spending less money. They're saving more because each month they're sending money home. Mm-hmm. And actually, whenever they go back to their countries, they're also expecting to have certain amount of money that they can take with them. So I'll say that's the difference, right? Whereas the ones who are looking to stay for a longer period of time, they're just like, okay, I want to do this right. I want to like take it slow, maybe not saving that much at the beginning because I know I have a lot of things that I have to spend like my money on. But yeah, I'll say that's the biggest difference.
We're seeing more and more newcomers do preparation in their home country before they get here. So it's not like they, you know, hop on the plane, they arrive, and it's all completely new. Many of the banks are investing in programs that begin before a newcomer hops on that plane. What advice would you have to newcomers in terms of that pre-work? Because there's tons of pre-work on visas and the permanent residency, and where am I going to live and all that stuff. What pre-work is the most helpful when it comes to finances, do you think?
I think understanding how the market and the institutions work in the country where you're going. So in Canada, as an example right now. And for that, you have to learn. And for learning, you have to watch tutorials. You have to look for different resources, like we recently partnered with Credit Canada, which they're doing an amazing job at trying to teach newcomers how to build their credit score from scratch, mm-hmm. from the ground up. And those things are really important because they're free resources that you can find online and you understand how everything works in this country, mm-hmm. how to get here, how to the different tactics for increasing that score during your first year or 2 years, what the different financial institutions look at when they look at your credit score, all of those things. So the credit score and the way you manage your finances become your friend and not your enemy when you arrive. That's mm-hmm. that's it. Yeah.
Thank you both for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bruce.
It was a pleasure to be being here with you.
Pleasure to talk to you and great to meet you. Carolina Restrepo and Juan Carla emigrated to Canada from Colombia about 6 years ago, thankfully in summer and not February. Okay, you two are a delight. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you making the time. It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Great to meet you too.
Have a great rest of your day.
Bye-bye. Ciao. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Coming up next on Moolala, more tips for building your credit history as a newcomer to Canada. Eva Wong, co-founder and chief operating officer at Borrowell, will be our guest. And later, Craig Hughes from IG Wealth Management is here to talk about the process of opening, funding, investing, and withdrawing from an RESP, a Registered Education Savings Plan. If you like what you heard today, or maybe even if you didn't, but you still want to try some different segments, head on over to moolala.ca. You can listen to full episodes. You can listen to particular segments on your computer or your phone. You can also go to the various podcast platforms out there, right? Amazon, Prime, Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you listen to podcasts. Download the episode, leave a review. We'd love that. And subscribe. That will make us more discoverable to others if you do subscribe. Stay with us. Moolala. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest-standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. So, of course, we're talking a ton about newcomers and credit this financial literacy month. So we're going to go to one of the experts in the field. Eva Wong is the co-founder and chief operating officer of Borrowell. This is a company that does many, many things. One of them is to enable you to check your credit score for free. And no surprise, they have a particular affinity for and focus on newcomers as a part of the important role that demographic plays in the future of Canada. Eva, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting and it's a really important topic.
It's a hugely important topic. We are going to talk about building your credit score. You've got lots of tips on that front. But there's also this question of what happens before people arrive in this country. And there is an issue for those who have a good score in their home country. How do they port that to Canada? And there's some work being done. We've talked to the CEO of Nova Credit and there's stuff happening. Sometimes they do not have a good score in their home country. And there's a question for some people as to whether that weak credit score could affect their ability to immigrate. What's your insight on that question?
Well, there's good news there in that if you don't have great credit in your home country, that isn't something that the government of Canada looks at and not something that would impact your ability to immigrate. The other piece of good news is that your credit scores and credit report from your home country don't follow you to Canada. So in a way, you have a clean slate.
Yeah. Which, you know, it's then you're starting from scratch, and the pros and then the challenges associated with that will follow. You That's are right. a huge advocate for this, as am I. Talk a bit about the case you would make for a newcomer to Canada on why building a solid credit score is important to their life.
So the thing about living in Canada, which is different from living in lots of other countries around the world, is that, first of all, there is such a thing as a credit score. And secondly, it's pretty important to your life. So anything from renting an apartment to getting a job to applying for any kind of credit, whether that be a car loan, a credit card, or a mortgage, typically requires a credit score. Or at least the person, whether it's your landlord, employer, or a potential lender, is going to ask to see your credit score and report. So it actually is really important, as much as you can, to have a strong credit score and to have a good credit history.
Free credit scores put Borrowell on the map. You have many, many people who use your service and have a, you know, an ongoing relationship with Borrowell because of that. For someone who has not been here, they sign up for your free credit score. What happens if they have no records? Does it just say, we don't know who you are, you're ineligible, or does it score them a zero? What would they see when they fill in all their data?
Yes, it's possible that if you have nothing, that we would not be able to find a credit file for you. Or it's possible that if there is something there, that you would have a zero score, which it sounds terrible to have a zero score. It's not necessarily a bad score. It just means that there's not enough information to calculate a credit score. But we do have some options for people who are in that situation. As you know, Bruce, we were the first company to allow tenants to report their rent to the credit bureau. And so if you're paying rent, you could sign up to do that, which is nice because it doesn't put an inquiry on your account. It doesn't mean that you're applying for credit. It just enables you to report something that you're already paying. And that could be something that helps you either establish a credit file or even a credit score. So we looked and we had a number of people who had a zero score when they signed up to Rent Advantage. And within 6 months, 100% of them had a credit score.
Wow. Okay. Now, do you have the data on those who had a credit score, but a weak credit score, and how quickly Rent Advantage was able to build that? Do you have any insight on how effective it is in that regard?
We do. So a percentage of those would have a credit score increase even in month one. What we saw is about 65% had a credit score increase in 4 or 5 months.
Wow. That's pretty notable. That's notable. And the other thing in terms of this demographic is there are some economic immigrants who are like slapping down, you know, a couple million dollars in cash for a condo. Those folks are few and far between. By far, the majority of newcomers would need to rent, even if they have capital in another country and they're going to buy eventually. Yeah. But it would seem almost like a first step for them to ensure that they're getting credit for that, the reliable behavior of paying their rent on time.
Yeah, that's right. And I just found the stat, more than 50% of members see a credit score increase by month one. So that's really encouraging.
Wow. So there are a number of key variables. You know, the first one is payment history. Pay on time every single time, no matter what. Pay on time every single time.
Yeah.
One of the things that Borrowell wrote about in a blog, which I hadn't thought of, is the benefit of being an authorized user on a credit card. And I know this doesn't work all the time, every time, but it sounds like there are two benefits. One is a potential credit score bump. But second, just the ability to transact using plastic.
That's right. And so, I mean, I actually just did this. I just got a new credit card and I had the option to get a second card for my husband. And so I thought, okay, well, it's free to do that. And then as he uses the card, we could build more points. And so in that situation, my husband is an authorized user of the credit card. He gets his own card. It's in his name. And so he has all the benefits of using that card and getting, you know, the points together as a family. But I think, you know, you made the point that maybe it doesn't have to even be a family member. It could just be someone else, because the person who is the primary account holder is the one taking the risk. So as long as there's someone that, you know, trusts that you're going to use this product responsibly, you could have someone who could be the person who's getting the credit for you, and then you'd be an authorized user for that.
And I think that the risk perhaps is more pronounced for newcomers in that they may be less aware of how significant the consequences are of, you know, not paying that bill on time, or hitting the max on that credit card, or opening up multiple credit accounts at any given time. Is that a fair assertion, that the asterisk that goes beside this potential strategy should be, you know, taken into account?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, with all credit, we should be using it responsibly, right? So that means not running it up to the maximum limit. It means not applying for a credit that you're not able to pay for. And so, yeah, it's really important that as people access credit, they're also using it responsibly. And as you mentioned, making those payments on time.
One of the things that Borrowell does in the context of, you know, when you sign up for the credit score is you've got this kind of credit coach thing, and it goes through the variables and highlights particular areas of opportunity for each individual to say, hey, like, this is the thing you need to work on. One of the ones that I think is the hardest for people to grasp is utilization, the utilization number. Can you talk a bit about how that works and why it's so important?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And you're right. Like, our credit coach does go through the different credit factors, and it's a really easy stoplight system where it just sort of shows, are you, you know, red, yellow, or green? And utilization essentially is, you know, talking about of the credit you have available to you, how much of it are you using? So let's say you have, for ease of calculation, a credit card with a limit of $1,000, and you've used $300 of that. You have a 30% credit utilization, and that's really healthy. That's really great. Lenders get nervous once that runs up. Like, let's say you've got $900 and then $950. There's a concern that if you run up to the limit and then you get a flat tire and you have to, you know, put another $300 somewhere, that you won't be able to manage that. And so that's why credit utilization is important to a lender. They want to see it low so that if you have an emergency, you still have room. And they get nervous once your credit utilization gets, you know, maybe in the 80, 90, 100% range for sure.
There is a level to which you can build your credit history and improve your credit score just through organic behavior. So you graduate from a secured card to an unsecured card, you pay it on time, you gradually ask for a higher limit or whatever. Mm-hmm. For some people, that's insufficient for a variety of reasons. And Borrowell has this thing called a credit builder loan. For whom is that a fit for? Because my starting point is, don't do that. Just do it the organic way. Just do it the simple way. For whom is that a product that you could recommend in good conscience and feel like the cost benefit was worth it? Because it's not for.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of important use cases. One, let's say that you want to buy a house. You're saving up for a down payment and you want to be able to qualify for a mortgage, but you don't have the credit score. Or even if you have the credit score, a lender might look at your credit profile and say, you might have a high credit score, but you have a thin file, which means that you don't have that many accounts that that credit score is built off of. I don't know if I can trust you with the $500,000 loan. So having a few other types of credit, showing that you're making payments on those on a regular basis, is important, not only for improving your score, but to prove to a lender that you can actually be trusted with a bunch of different kinds of credit. And so that's one example. Another is if you don't have $500 sitting around to put against a secured credit card, and you're really in this chicken and egg situation where no one will give you credit because you haven't proven that you can use it responsibly, and then you can't get credit. So it's one of those things that a credit building loan is perfect for, because you don't have to have an existing credit score. We don't check that. You don't even have to have an existing credit history. You can just sign up and you start making payments. And then we report those payments to the credit bureau. And in a sense, it's like being put towards a savings account. And you can use that in order at the end to maybe put that into a secured credit card. So it's a bit of like a fourth saving secured loan product.
All right, we're going to wrap up with one last question here. And that is, your single most important piece of advice that you would give to a newcomer? So, you know, someone introduces you to this person, they're fresh to this country, they are wide-eyed and optimistic about the future that they are going to build, and you get one piece of advice to provide them that you hope will make the biggest difference for them when it comes to their credit.
Bruce, this is too easy. It's too easy. I would obviously wait for it. I would tell them to get their credit score for free from Borrowell, because that sets you on the journey. I think without that knowledge, you don't know where you stand. And that sets you on a journey to build great credit. So get your credit score for free from Borrowell.
Normally, I would roll my eyes and say that is the most self-serving piece of advice I've ever heard. But I think I'm going to say, regardless of whether it's Borrowell or one of your horrendous competitors, getting that credit score from the get-go and having the monthly reminder of that is so critical. And I know that's one thing that Borrowell does.
Yeah, we do it weekly.
Oh, yes. My gosh. Wow. Yeah. Well, soon you'll move to daily and then I'll really notice. Eva, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Bruce. Great to chat with you as always.
Eva Wong, co-founder and chief operating officer of Borrowell. Credit Canada has made a huge, huge effort to support newcomers this Financial Literacy Month. And one of the things that we spent a tremendous amount of time on, and we are tremendously proud of, is our e-learning platform. It is called Building Credit from the Ground Up, a program for newcomers to Canada. And get this, we have done this e-learning program in 8 languages: English, French, Arabic, Farsi, Hindi, Spanish, Simplified Chinese, and Tagalog. And so whatever language you choose, you're going to do 4 modules. They're each under 15 minutes, and they include quizzes and case studies and other little interactive elements. And each week I've been talking about one of the modules. This being week 3, I'll say we're particularly proud of the module we did on how to improve your credit score, because it's very simple to see what you need to improve your credit score. It's simple to know what to do. It is difficult to actually do what there is to do. This e-learning is free thanks to our sponsors, creditcanada.com/newcomers, creditcanada.com/newcomers. All right, stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, all you need to know about opening up a registered education savings plan. Craig Hughes from IG Wealth Management takes us through that process and why it is so, so important. But first, Mike Von Masso, food economist and professor at the University of Guelph, is here to talk about tipping. So you may have heard the story about DoorDash. I think it is fascinating. He's going to give us his take. One last thing. Let's talk about book clubs. If you were in a book club, how about you choose a money book? I know, right? So fun. Everybody reads the same money book and you get to talk about it as a group. The first book I wrote is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. It's available on all the book platforms, on Kindle, on Kobo, all that, and from your public library. So bring it to your book club and have a good natter about it with a glass of Pinot Grigio.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
In Canada, when you go to a restaurant, when you go to a hair salon, it is proper etiquette to leave a tip. This has been, you know, the way it's been for decades here, less different in other parts of the world, but here in Canada, that's kind of the drill. Nowadays, though, it seems like we're getting prompted to leave a tip everywhere. And recently, delivery services like DoorDash, this is the one that's getting most of the PR, are prompting you to leave a tip even before that service happens. DoorDash is testing out a warning to customers, letting them know that if you don't leave a tip, you may have to wait longer for your order. So today we're going to talk about tipping with Mike Von Masso, He is a food economist and professor at the University of Guelph, and he joins us today from Guelph, Ontario. Hello there, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What was your reaction when you heard this thing about DoorDash, that they're testing this warning so customers will know that their order may take longer if they don't tip? What did you make of it?
Well, I'd like to say I was surprised, but I've become numb to some of the things that are happening in tipping culture today. And essentially what they're doing, they're doing this warning because my guess is they've gotten complaints from customers who said, my service is really slow, my food didn't get here, and all of those sorts of things. And they then looked and said, they either talked to their drivers or they looked at their files and said, these people aren't tipping as much. And so our contract drivers aren't working as hard for them. And so they're doing the warning, frankly, to reduce the risk of an unhappy customer because of a failed delivery service. So to me, it's not surprising. It's disappointing. What it tells us now is that we have two-tiered delivery from DoorDash. Yeah. If you pay the top dollar, that is, you tip, which is no longer a voluntary thank you. It is a fee in advance. If you pay the top dollar, you'll get great delivery. If you pay the low dollar, you'll get worse service.
It sounds very much like the difference between Highway 401, which is free for all, lightly congested at best, and the Highway 407, which for those people who don't live anywhere near Toronto, is a toll road north of the city. You pay an arm and a leg, but boy, you blast across the city much, much quicker. So I think you're right. That two-tiered notion is a way to describe that. Is this the beginning of a trend?
Well, I think there's a few things to keep in mind here on tipping. The first is that we're seeing, as you said, a wider range of places asking for tips. We're also seeing an increase in the amount that they're asking for, where it used to be sort of an unspoken rule that it was around 15%. Now that we're seeing it on these payment machines, we're getting nudged higher and higher. But to me, this is now saying, well, tips aren't voluntary anymore at all. You used the 401, 407 analogy. I was on a flight last week, and you could use first class and economy as the difference. And the difference is no longer a price difference, but it is a quote unquote tip difference. And so to me, this is organizations trying to change the tip from this social norm to an explicit part of the price we pay for services.
It is not a tip. It is a tax. It is largely a tax now.
It's a fee.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you're an economist. There is typically an inverse relationship between increased prices and decreased demand. Now that we are seeing effectively a price increase in so many areas of our spending pattern, do you think that will lead to a decrease in demand for some of these areas in which tipping has become not optional, but a fee on top of and a mandatory practice?
Well, I think it's a great question. I think there's a couple of things going on here. I think the first one is we've got companies trying to separate the price so that we don't think about the total. We think, oh, this is what it's going to cost us, and that tip becomes an afterthought, whether it's voluntary or not. So by splitting those prices, they try and mask these price increases. The other sort of benefit for the company for calling it a tip rather than a fee is that it means that companies don't have to pay payroll taxes on it, right? They say that's a tip. That's a nice, voluntary interaction with that customer and our independent, or even if it's an employee in a restaurant, that money goes direct and the restaurant doesn't have to pay EI or CPP, or most of them are small enough they don't have to pay employer health tax, but so it saves them some money. And so there's their motivation, both in terms of masking price increases and maybe reducing costs. But I think for sure that we're seeing people sort of push back. They're, you know, food prices are up generally, so we're seeing food service probably down a little bit, just because that's one of the first places we change our behavior relative to to buying, to spending money on food. And so we'll see decreases in demand, which increases the incentive to sort of split those prices to make it less obvious, like resort fees when you go to a destination. The other thing I think is happening is not just a price response, but sort of a pushback where people are saying, you know, I'm not comfortable with how much you're asking for. You know, the psychology research is pretty clear that our last experience is often that what sticks with us. And many of us are saying, oh, they're asking for that much money, or they're pushing us for that much money, that it's leaving a bad taste in people's mouths. So I think there is the price effect, that demand decreasing effect that you outlined. But I think there's also people pushing back and saying, look, you're just asking for too much. I'm either going to decrease or I'm going to go somewhere else. So I think companies have to be careful with how far they're pushing people here.
Now, we know that a lot of people who work in the gig economy, which is where, so I mean, we're talking about DoorDash off the top, and that goes for any of the other delivery options out there. These folks have a hard time sometimes making a living wage, given that they're paying all the increased prices that everybody in this country is paying. What are the alternatives? So if there was, because a lot of people like me, I'm happy to pay the money. I just don't like the way it's being served up. I'd rather it was just included in the price and I don't have to think about it, because I don't like tipping in categories in which it is counter to the practice that we've known for decades. What are the other alternatives to increase the probability of these humans earning a living wage that isn't this particular way?
Well, it's a great question. And I think what you've got is the issue of a fair pay, both for the gig economy workers, like these delivery people are often independent contractors, quote unquote, but also for people who are earning minimum wage in server roles, in kitchens, or in other places. We've got this sort of disparity, and we between individual customers. So in the end, I think there are lots of people like you and me who say, I'd rather just pay for the value you're creating for me, the service experience, the food experience, and have those of you who are either delivering my food or serving my food or cutting my hair or doing whatever, get paid a fair wage, and then we know what it is, and we don't have that uncomfortable feeling at the end. The problem is we have this transition because most of these organizations are small companies. And so if you are a restaurant that says we are going to go no tipping, it's usually not the customers who are unhappy with that decision. It is sometimes the staff. Clearly, right. Everyone thinks they are better than everyone else, so they think their earnings are above and beyond. And we already talked about taxation. I think that's a real thing. So it would be, to me, one option is to pay people for the value they create and charge us as consumers more for it. Now, people are worried that will decrease demand, and it might. But what we're doing is we are essentially lowering prices. We're asking these individual workers to subsidize our experience, and the companies don't want to pay them. And we don't want to pay. So at some point, I think a reasonable alternative would be to pay these people more, include it in the price, and just make this a lot easier. You know, and it works, frankly, for places like Amazon. I don't get asked to tip my Amazon driver. I don't get to ask to tip the guy who delivers the beer from the microbrewery that I like to order mine from. So clearly some companies have made it work and pay these people fairly and in a way that they can attract those people to work for them.
Really interesting stuff. Mike, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Mike von Massow is a professor and food economist at the University of Guelph, and he was here to talk about this ever-changing tip culture that we live in particular, the starting off point, this news from DoorDash that you're going to get prompted to tip before your service even happens. It's a test, but I don't like it. Coming up, saving for your child's post-secondary education. Craig Hughes from IG Wealth Management is here for all you need to know about opening, funding, investing, and withdrawing from a registered education savings plan. And hey, get inspired to get a better handle on your money by signing up for the Moolala newsletter. You will receive very simple, basic, relevant, practical financial tips and tricks that you can put into practice today. This newsletter brings together stuff we do on this show, on Sirius XM, on CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg. Just head on over to moolala.ca to subscribe. We will never do anything with your email address, and that newsletter gets sent once per month.
We all believe in the possibilities of tomorrow. And at Easy Financial, we're here to help you every step of the way. If the banks aren't an option, we can help get you approved for a loan in as little as 10 minutes. And with our personal, home equity, and auto loans, you can choose the loan that's right for you, so you can start rebuilding your credit for a better tomorrow. Apply today without affecting your credit score at easyfinancial.com or at over 400 locations and find out how much you can qualify for. Easy Financial. Better tomorrows.
There is no such thing as a free lunch, ever, except the Registered Education Savings Plan. This literally is the closest thing I can think of to a free lunch. If you have kids, if you have grandkids, if you have nieces and nephews, or if you were yourself a kid once, you really need to be paying attention here. You really need to be thinking about an RESP because of the government grant and the magic of compounding. So this is a topic that we've talked about on the show before. This is a topic that we also get all sorts of questions about, even though we have talked about it before. So we're going to do it again with Craig Hughes. Craig is the Director of Tax and Estate Planning at IG Wealth Management, and he joins us today from Winnipeg, Manitoba. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am great. My kid is now almost 14, and I followed my own advice on the RESP. So I am feeling very good with 13 years of a government grant and the compounding that goes alongside that. For those who are less familiar or who need a little bit of a reminder, what should they know about what an RESP is?
So, like you mentioned, the name, it's in the title. So it's a savings plan for education. So for post-secondary education, and that can cover a wide variety of things, university, college, trades, technical certifications. So there's a broad definition here when I speak to what education means. And basically what it is an individual can set up one of these RESP accounts for a beneficiary. So usually, a child, typically, or it could be a number of children. You can have numerous beneficiaries, for example, siblings. A parent could open what's called a family RESP and have multiple children under that plan. And basically, as money is added to that plan, the government also puts money in there, and they do that in a couple of ways. One is the Canada Education Savings Grant. So for every dollar that you put in, the government will put 20 cents in, so 20% basically. And that's up to $500 a year the government will put in. So for example, if you put $2,500 into an RESP, the government will also add $500. If you missed a year, that's fine. That grant carries forward to a maximum of $1,000 in a year. So for example, you could put $5,000 into an RESP in a year. And if you've missed a year, you could receive up to $500 in grants. as well as for low-income families, there's ability to receive additional grants as well. They have what's called a Canada Learning Bond, where for low-income families as well, it's possible to receive up to $2,000 over a child's lifetime in bond, which can also add to that RESP. And then, as you mentioned, it then grows. It grows. It's typically invested within the account, and it grows on a tax-deferred basis. So it continues to compound without having annual taxation on that amount. And then lastly, just as an overview, when funds are withdrawn, that growth and those grants are taxable, but typically they're taxable to the student. And so often at that point in time, they're in a low income tax bracket because, you know, they're in education. And, you know, they might be eligible for tuition expenses and things like that, various credits. And so often that money can then be withdrawn at a very low or nil tax rate when they're actually pursuing post-secondary education.
The question that prompted this interview was when should I open up an RESP for my kid? I have my answer, but you go first.
Well, the earlier the better. Obviously, like I said, you can receive up to $500 in grants every year. The lifetime amount that you can receive from the government is $7,200. So the earlier you can do it, you can start to receive that $500 a year and build that up over time. And obviously, that's going to take a number of years to get to that $7,200. As well, you're starting to, like I said, the money is invested. You're starting to initiate that tax-deferred, compounding growth. So the sooner you can do it, the better. The money will grow over time. You know, we're talking about a longer time horizon here, given it's post-secondary education. So you could be talking 18 years or more. And so that long time frame gives you a lot of, period to build that money. But I get it. I have two kids too, and there's lots of priorities going on when.
Sure. Now, you are more measured than I am. I am evangelical about this. I'm highly excitable about the RESP. So my answer, which is not different from yours, but my answer is literally the day you get the social insurance number, literally that day you open up an RESP. That is my answer. So sooner the better, but I say the day you get the SIN. The process is pretty simple, right? And you can open up an RESP at any bank, credit union, investment shop, brokerage, right? It's pretty wide.
Yeah, it's a very common savings plan type. So for sure, if you go to any financial institution, larger financial institution, that they'll be able to offer an RESP. Yeah, so it's very simple to do it. It'll be a case of signing a few forms. And once you start depositing money, you'll start to receive that grant. Yeah. And it's hard to beat that as a rate of return because you've been given free money essentially. And so great way to start saving for your child's future. Because obviously post-secondary education is going to help them realize their goals as to what they want to do when they're older and set themselves up for life. So it's
so that's the open it. Then there's the fund it. And finally, there's the invest it. On the fund it, if you can swing the cash flow, please tell me you're a fan of the automatic monthly contribution.
Yeah, for sure. Then you set it, let it go. It's an expense at that point. You can budget for that. You know when it's going to come out and for how much, and you leave that and you're not tempted to divert that to other things. So for sure. As well, from an investment perspective, you're not lumping money into the market, which, if you time it wrong, that could be a bad thing. So the more you can spread it out and do it periodically, typically that smooths out your returns. Well, like I said, from a budget perspective, it's easy.
And I don't want to minimize that it is not easy for a family to find $250 per child per month. I know for some families, that is just an unimaginable situation. But if you can swing it, that automatic monthly contribution is genius. Okay, so you've got open it, then fund it, then investment, then invest it. What guidance would you provide in terms of where it should go. I mean, you've got somewhere between, 15 and 18 years before this money is going to be withdrawn. And I say 15 because if it's connected to equities, you're not going to want to keep it in equities until the day the tuition is due. That could be fraught. But what would you say? What are some things that you'd say people should keep in mind as they think about investing that money?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, ideally, you'd work with a financial advisor at the financial institution. They'll help you with that, make sure you're diversified. Usually in the earlier years, you probably want to be more growth orientated, stocks and things like that. Because you've got a longer time horizon, so you can deal with the ups and downs of the market. As you approach your child reaching 18, 19, whenever they're thinking about pursuing post-secondary education, usually then you'd want to start moving towards fixed income, preserving that capital. And certain financial institutions will offer what's called target education portfolios. So they'll start off equity orientated, and then over time, they'll shift that asset allocation towards fixed income investments just to try and get the growth in the early years and try and preserve your capital when you need it the most in order to start funding that education.
Of course, the last step here is, so you've opened it, you've funded it, you've invested it, and then you got to withdraw it. What are some things to keep in mind as you move into that phase? I mean, some kids will take, let's say it's just one individual, and they're good planning on doing a four-year program of some sort. Some will take it in each of those 4 years, but it doesn't necessarily have to be equal by year. What does it have to be? It has to be a registered institution, and the list is long. What else should people know about how they withdraw that money?
Yeah, the list is long. Full-time studies qualify as well as part-time studies. Very long list. As long as post-secondary education is being pursued, shouldn't really be a problem. So the contribution, so the money that you've put into it, if the individual is pursuing post-secondary education, that can be pulled out tax-free. So very easy to deal with the capital of the plan. In terms of the growth, any earnings as well as those grants or any bonds that have been paid into the plan, in the first 13 weeks that somebody's enrolled full-time in a program, in 2023, they've increased this. You can withdraw up to $8,000 of that income. So you can supplement that with the contributions. But you can pull out up to $8,000 of the income, $4,000 if it's a part-time course. And then thereafter, there's not really any restrictions. There is a reasonableness test. So as long as you're pulling out less than $20,000, $7,000 of income, you're not going to hit that test. So that shouldn't be a concern. But basically, you can pull that out. You have to show proof of enrollment to the financial institution, and then you can start pulling out the contributions and the income. Usually, it gets paid to the beneficiary, to the student. It's taxed to them, like I said, at low tax rates. And then they can use that for a wide variety of educational expenses. So it's not just tuition. It can be used for housing.
It's keg parties. It's kegs. It's kegs.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It's also kegs.
Exactly. Yeah.
One quick thing before we go. Every parent needs to have a certain level of diluted optimism, because how would we get through the day if we didn't have that? Yep. And not every kid is going to go to post-secondary. They're just not. So what happens if you do all this saving? You save for almost 20 years and your kid does not go.
Right. So there's a few options. So as I mentioned at the beginning, you can have the concept of a family RESP, or even if you don't, if you have an individual RESP, it's possible to shift that income and the contributions over to a sibling fairly easily. If that's just not an option, then the contributions, like I mentioned, can always be withdrawn tax-free, so that money's not lost. The grants and bonds would not be paid out of the plan if nobody's attending post-secondary education, but the growth and the earnings, that can be paid out to the subscribers, so the person who set up the RESP, and that can be paid to them. It is taxed, but if they have RSP room, they're able to put it into an RSP, which eliminates any taxation. And there's also an additional 20% tax, but that can be eliminated if you have RSP. Right. Room. So the results.
And they've got time. These young people have time. What is it, 35 or something like that? The RESP can sit there for, that's a long time.
Yeah, the RESP can be open up to 35 years after the year of setup. So it's not something that you need to make a decision on right away, and circumstances change. So it's not something you need to close right away.
Craig.
It doesn't work out at 18, so.
Craig, thank you for your time. This is a really critical conversation to have with parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles, and we need to have it over and over again such that we increase the number of young people who have the benefit of these government grants and the compounding interest. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you.
Craig Hughes, Director of Tax Planning at IG Investments. He joined us today from Winnipeg, Manitoba. That is our show for today. A thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, Easy Financial, personal home equity and auto loans with personalized rates and terms made for you, Indeed Canada, the number one job site worldwide, the Canadian Bankers Association, the voice of 60 domestic and foreign banks here in Canada, and Achieve, a leading charitable organization that delivers employment, newcomer, and inclusion services in the Greater Toronto area. If you have thoughts on our show, ideas, questions, best way to get a hold of us is email ask@moolala.ca, ask@moolala.ca. And don't forget to stay up to date on all things Moolala. You can do so by subscribing to our newsletter. It is that subscription is done easily for free at moolala.ca. On social media, I'm Bruce Celery @BruceCelery on X, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.